The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, is it wrong to make fun of somebody else's religion? Well, my friend, making fun of another as an end in itself, just for the purpose of being cruel, that would be wrong. But there is such a thing as satire, and there is such a thing as taking a stand, and there is such a thing as taking a stand through the use of satire. There's also such a thing as asking which religion we are talking about. And what it is exactly that we are taking a stand against. This brings us to a rather important conversation our country is having this week. It all began where so many controversies begin, in Texas. Well, now where else would it have been? The good news is that two gunmen whom ISIS claimed responsibility for, in an attempt to wage jihad against the participants of a Mohammed cartoon drawing contest in Garland, Texas, were stopped and killed by some well-organized security, which anticipated the possibility of such action. That's the good news. The bad news is that many are condemning the contest as much, if not more, than the would-be killers. Organizer of the event is outspoken Pamela Geller, a publisher of the blog Atlas Shrugs and president of the American Freedom Defense Initiative. She defended the cartoon drawing event as being in honor of Charlie Hebdo, the French newspaper that was attacked a few months ago for its use of satire regarding the Prophet Muhammad. Frequently accused of being anti-Muslim, Geller retorts. She says, "The problem is that a group attempted to open fire on a gathering of free speech. No one is saying that there aren't peaceful Muslims, but there is a problem in Islam, as illustrated last night, and anyone that addresses it gets attacked in the same way." Now, unfortunately, the politically correct these days are quite adept at throwing around sound bites as an alternative to meaningful dialogue. This is not the first time they have vilified Geller. Neither will it be the last. Perhaps those who wish to speak some sense would do well to counter with a few sound bites of their own so that courageous people such as Pamela Geller do not feel like they have to stand alone. In that vein, allow me to offer some quick defenses to some of the more ignorant attacks. One attack comes from the Anti-Defamation League. They say Geller is vilifying the Islamic faith under the guise of fighting radical Islam. Ladies and gentlemen, actually, it is not radical Islam that commands jihad. Rather, it is regular, ordinary Islam, the religion itself, the Quran itself, Muhammad himself. Such commands can be found clearly in the Quran as dictated by Muhammad, who brought Islam into power by conquering Mecca. How do you think he conquered Mecca? By offering community midnight basketball? By riding around in an ice cream truck? So let's be clear. It is the peaceful Muslims who are radically deviating from their faith. And there is a Muslim who writes for CNN, Harun Mogul, and he wrote about Geller. She went on Fox News and called it a war. And that appears to be what she wants. It is not Pamela Geller who has declared war. It is Islamic organizations such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They may not have been shy about their objective. They're not shy about their objective. They make it clear every single day. And New Day host Allison Camerata, while interviewing Geller, said there's a fine line between freedom of speech and being intentionally incendiary and provocative. Folks, the whole idea behind our First Amendment was to protect offensive speech. If all speech was going to be friendly and benign, we would need no legal protections. And while we're on the subject of being incendiary and provocative, keep in mind that this event was designed as a reaction against the incendiary and provocative threats coming our way from jihadists, particularly the ruthless murders of many people at the staff of Charlie Hebdo magazine. It was a time for courageous people to come together in solidarity, letting the world know we will not be intimidated. Another attack. The Huffington Post calls Geller Islamophobic. Dictionary time! Phobia simply means fear, and fear is a neutral word. The appropriateness or inappropriateness of fear depends upon the situation. If jihadists have declared war upon the United States and Western civilization, perhaps some sobering fear is warranted. And yet, ironically, the whole purpose behind Geller's cartoon contest was to take a stand against ugly threats rather than being fearful. But if you're waiting for Geller to be called Islamo-courageous, don't hold your breath. And then, oh, you gotta always love the Southern Poverty Law Center. They have Geller on a list of hate groups. Once again, we are dealing with a neutral word. Some things deserve to be hated. After all, would not Southern Poverty Law Center be the first to say that they hate racism? Wouldn't they be the first to say that they hate bigotry? Well, Geller hates murderers who kill people for drawing cartoons. What part of that are we not understanding? And then according to the Washington Post, some Muslims in Garland, Texas called this event blasphemous. Now, putting aside the fact that nowhere in the Quran are we told that we're not allowed to draw Muhammad, it's not in there anyway. Okay, I'll accept the fact that Muslims sincerely believe this. So what? So what? The event may be blasphemous to Muslims, but to those who do not share the Muslim faith, it is not blasphemous. We are not obligated to take on the avoidance of blasphemy as a border to our speech. I'm a Christian. Many Christians were upset years ago with an artistic offering which placed a crucifix in a bottle of urine, and they called it art. And oh, how people stood behind the person's First Amendment rights. Nobody worried that a bunch of nuns or priests were going to gun down the artist. This is because most Christians have accepted the fact that what Jesus means to them is not to be imposed upon others. And then in response to Geller's Subway ads a while back, this was another time she got herself into a mess, Subway ads which called jihadists savages, many New Yorkers called Geller a racist. Spoiler alert, Islam is not a race. It is a religion. Not everybody in the Middle East is Muslim, and many people in the West, including Americans, are Muslim. What Geller is objecting to is a religious-based ideology. But perhaps the most pathetic criticism of all comes from Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, a former NYPD officer who was also denouncing Geller's New York City ads. He says, "This is irresponsible. It is no different than sitting in a crowded room yelling fire." Wow. What an original thought. I wonder how long it took for him to come up with that one. It's tired drivel. The notion that freedom of speech does not give us the right to yell fire in a crowded room. Well, I guess that all depends on whether or not there really is a fire. If a real honest-to-goodness fire is blazing in a crowded room, failing to alert the crowd is negligent and irresponsible. In the case of modern-day jihadists, the fire is there. Burying our heads in the sand will not discourage groups like ISIS from cutting them off. Let me be as clear as I possibly can. This radio show will stand by Pamela Geller. She has a right to protest anything she wants, and she has the right to do it with satire, should she so desire. Satire is nothing new for the Bob Siegel Show. We frequently feature satire anyway, and we've been doing it for years. Satire makes an important point, but in a different kind of way. It reaches those who might not respond to other forms of communication. Often it makes the obvious obvious, and of course, as you know, that's the objection of this program, making the obvious obvious. Does this mean I have a desire to make fun of Muslims? That all depends. It all depends. I have had Muslim guests on this program for debates and discussions. They have always been treated with respect. Part of the reason is that many sincere Muslims seem unaware of what their own founder taught. And they are sincere when they claim mistakenly that the Quran is a peaceful book. They are sincere when they claim mistakenly that Muhammad was a peaceful leader. He was not. If we were talking about Buddha, it would be different. I'm not a Buddhist either, but I would not call Buddha a jihadist because Buddha wasn't a jihadist. Muhammad is another story. I do not treat jihadists with respect. And ladies and gentlemen, Muhammad was the first jihadist. The politically correct, in their zeal to defend Islam, are defending the religion in ways Muhammad himself would have been unfamiliar with. If we can wake people up to the fact that the PC movement is acting like a battered wife defending her abusive husband, then I will do so, and I will do so any way I can. I will do it with spurious speech. I will do it with satire. And I can't think of a better time to do satire than today as a way of showing my solidarity with Pamela Geller. And who better to explain the relationship between the jihad movement and the PC movement than our own Smiley Miley.
Hey kids, you all know what it's like to have a fire drill or an earthquake drill, and I know you've grown to love those little drills, especially when the bell goes off in the middle of a math test. Well, this year, boys and girls, we're going to try something special, a new kind of drill. It's called the jihad drill. Do you know what a jihad is? It's a holy war. I'll bet you didn't know a war could be holy. Holy wars used to be fought with swords, but that was in the olden days. Today they use bombs instead. Therefore, when the bell rings for a jihad drill, it means somebody has set off a bomb at your school, or at least delivered a bomb threat. Yes, jihad drills are important, but that doesn't mean we're against jihads. After all, jihad is a practice of the religion of Islam, and we must never object to a religious practice unless the practice includes a cross or a Christmas tree. Crosses and trees suppress people's rights, but the spread of jihad is merely the spreading of peace, because Islam is the religion of peace. How do we know it's a religion of peace? Because Muslims tell us it's a religion of peace, silly. Oh, sure, once in a while they kill in the name of their religion, but Christianity did the same thing 1,000 years ago. Besides, we wouldn't have jihads at all if your mommies and daddies weren't driving those gas-guzzling SUVs. The nice Muslims are merely trying to teach the oil-sucking Americans a lesson. So if one of your little playmates gets blown up with a bomb, don't blame religion, because that's not nice. And don't blame people, because that's not nice. Just blame your SUVs. SUVs aren't alive, and you can't hurt their feelings, and they aren't as important as people. But SUVs run on oil, and too much oil drilling is bad for the environment. It kills trees, and trees are as important as people. It's wrong to drill for oil in America, but it's okay to drill for oil in Muslim countries. See the difference? But it's wrong to buy too much oil from Muslim countries because all that money makes the nice Muslims want to go on a jihad. And that's why we have jihad drills. So let's review. We have fire drills, earthquake drills, and jihad drills. The next time somebody insults Muslims and tells you they haven't added any traditions to our culture, you can just remind them about the jihad drill. That's all for this week, kids.
You don't have to go along with the political correct talking points. Just because people say Islam is a religion of peace, that doesn't mean you have to say it. Just because you've been taught that it's wrong to evaluate the truth or falsehood of a religion, that doesn't mean you have to. You can think for yourself. You can conduct your own investigation. You can march to the beat of a different drum.
Nobody can tell you. There's only one song worth singing. They may try
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, W&S Electric.
Hi, I'm Dana Wright, here to talk about Bob Siegel's book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... The title itself is an open-ended question. You fill in the rest. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but... Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? How will God judge people who never heard of Jesus? Can a scientific mind really accept miracles? These are but some of the concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book has been enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians alike. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Welcome back to 1170 The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. During a press conference with Japan's prime minister, President Obama commented on the Baltimore violence that broke forth like a tidal wave. As a reaction to the death of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old black man, while in the custody of police a few weeks ago, three of those six officers charged, by the way, are themselves African-American. You hardly ever hear anything about that. Anyway, early in his speech, Obama condemned the violence. He says, it is counterproductive. When individuals get crossbars and start prying open doors to loot, they're not protesting. They're not making a statement. They're stealing. When they burn down a building, they're committing arson. And they're destroying and undermining businesses and opportunities in their own communities that rob jobs and opportunity from people in that area. Okay, I don't really think the president's making some original statement that we didn't know, but at least he's condemning the violence. Unfortunately, as to be expected, the president then went on to say other things. The overwhelming majority of the community in Baltimore, I think, have handled this appropriately, expressing real concern and outrage over the possibility that our laws were not applied evenly in the case of Mr. Gray, and that accountability needs to exist. Since Ferguson and the task force that we put together, we have seen too many instances of what appears to be police officers interacting with individuals, primarily African-American, often poor, in ways that have raised troubling questions. And it comes up, it seems, like once a week now, or once every couple of weeks. And so I think it's pretty understandable why the leaders of civil rights organizations, but more importantly, moms and dads across the country, might start saying this is a crisis. What I'd say is this has been a slow-rolling crisis. This has been going on for a long time. This is not new. And we shouldn't pretend that it's new. I think there are police departments that have to do some soul-searching. I think there are some communities that have to do some soul-searching. But I think we as a country have to do some soul-searching. This is not new. It's been going on for decades. If we are serious about solving this problem, then we're going to not only have to help the police, we're going to have to think about what we can do, the rest of us. And there's a bunch of my agenda that would make a difference right now. Now, I'm not under the illusion that out of this Congress, we're going to get massive investments in urban communities. And so we'll try to find areas where we can make a difference around school reform and around job training and around some investments in infrastructure in these communities, trying to attract new businesses in. All right, now, perhaps Obama's most interesting words came with his call for national soul searching, all the while showing microscopic evidence that he ever searches his own soul. Yes, Mr. President, some soul searching is definitely in order. Soul searching such as the kind that evaluates whether the president should be making comments about the Baltimore Police Department before the investigation is completed. Not to mention lingering comments about Ferguson, inasmuch as the police officer involved was exonerated, not only by the grand jury, but by your own Justice Department. Perhaps such thoughtless, irresponsible statements contribute to the misdirected anger, taking the wind out of those earlier obligatory renunciations of the violence, which seem to serve as only a prelude for the matters you truly wish to discuss. And while we're on the subject of priorities, Mr. President, was this really the time to bring up your own political agenda and make yet another dig at the Republicans? No, Mr. President, soul-searching does not seem to be a habit of yours. We saw no soul-searching in your lies about health care, lies about Benghazi, lies about Fast and Furious, lies about the IRS scandal, or executive orders regarding illegal immigration, orders you yourself had said several times you did not even have the power to implement, and then you implemented them anyway. Ironically, soul-searching is just exactly what our nation needs right now in the face of such political balkanization and race-baiting, which divides rather than unites. But should we honor our president's call to soul-searching? Honoring his example would make about as much sense as holding up King George as a champion of colonists' rights. Well, if you'd like to weigh in on any of this, you can reach me, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel.net. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter. Richard says, regarding the Muhammad cartoon contest and Southern Poverty Law Center condemning Pamela Geller, he says, it never ceases to amaze me when the MSM dutifully reports that the Southern Poverty Law Center considers some right-of-center organization a terrorist organization. This sleazy outfit has a list of hundreds, if not thousands, of groups they consider dangerous, almost all right-of-center, and the press thinks they have credibility. SPLC is a propaganda outfit whose primary job is raising money from people who want all right-wingers and libertarians tagged as dangerous people. SPLC's radical ideological dovetails nicely with their greedy fundraising. Seems to me they will call anyone right of center a terrorist or at least a dangerous extremist if there's a buck in it for them. Now, Craig views this different. He says, also interesting is the way this event has divided conservative pundits. There are those conservatives who seem to believe that what Geller did was a commendable thing, while others, though fully persuaded of her right to hold the exhibit, disagree and argue that the gratuitous mockery or ridicule of religious beliefs is wrong, not illegal, but immoral. Well, that's true, Greg. This event does divide conservatives. For example, Franklin Graham, while willing to speak bravely against militant Islam, also says it's wrong for Geller to make fun of another person's religion. I do have a great respect for Franklin Graham and others like him. I understand the points they're making, but I also wonder how much the times are affecting the way people process all this. Back in the 1980s, when a fatwa was put on Salman Rushdie for writing the Satanic Verses, a novel that was offensive to Muslims, artists came together and did public readings of his novel in bookstores. I didn't hear people condemn those artists back in those days. I heard them condemn what the artists were protesting, the ugly threats against free speech. But without a doubt, these public readings were provoking the militant Muslims. Pamela Geller also held a provocative event. But just because an event is provocative, that doesn't mean it is wrong. Sometimes it's the only way to draw a line and call others to courage. She did this deliberately to protest the ruthless murders at Charlie Hebdo magazine. Supposing during World War II, somebody held an event that made fun of Hitler and his rather lengthy book, Mein Kampf. Or supposing they held a Hitler cartoon drawing contest. Actually, many political cartoons were drawn of Hitler. I'm trying to imagine people saying, look, why insult so many Germans? Okay, is it fair right now to compare Muhammad to Hitler? Well, Muhammad was not as much of a butcher, but he was a butcher. And butchers are beheading people. And they're basing it on things they're reading in the Quran. And they're basing it on the fact that Muhammad himself gave orders to behead people. You see, I think somehow we have it in our minds that since Muhammad was the founder of a religion, there must have been something sacred and inherently peaceful in his lifestyle. There was not. If people understood who Muhammad really was and what he really stood for, he would not be a hands-off subject. But it goes beyond who Muhammad was. We are losing our rights to freedom of speech in this country. They are already seeking to pass laws in the United Nations that make criticism of Islam hate speech and against international law. There are people in the United States who wish to do the same thing. Our First Amendment is going the way of the dinosaur, extinction. We must take a stand. And if a cartoon contest takes the stand, so be it. I would say the contest made its point. Somebody dropped by to assassinate the participants. They failed, but they arrived. Doesn't that speak volumes? And yet I'm hearing more condemnation of the victims than the potential murderers. How sad. How very sad. It's like blaming a rape victim because her clothes were provocative. In any event, Craig, I know you meant well with your comment, and I thank you for your comment. This is from Chris, also regarding what I had to say about the cartoon contest. He says, I must say, for someone that isn't a scientist, you sure have a way of using logic to point out the inconsistencies in the left. Well, thank you for the compliment, Chris. But Chris also asks a question. He says, Bob, I wanted to ask you a question about human nature, if you don't mind. You said something a few years ago I never forgot. I was asking you about a shady business partner that wouldn't admit any fault, no matter how many times I tried to point it out to him. You didn't seem surprised and told me that with some people, it is best to just not try to reach them if they aren't listening. Some people you just need to walk away from. I believe you referred to such people as having personality disorders. I think M. Scott Peck says they are narcissistic. What got me thinking about this is Bill and Hillary Clinton's continued denials of any wrongdoing. It seems like no matter how absurd things get, they never seem to notice that they may be at fault. Are such people just not living in reality? Are they really incapable of seeing the truth of their sin when it is right in front of them? I'm confused. You seem to not be confused or surprised. Well, Chris, it's possible that the Clintons have no conscience, which means they do see their sin, but do not care about their sin. But I can tell you this, the reason they keep lying and cheating is because our worthless mainstream media has led them to believe that they can get away with it. Also regarding Pamela Geller, this is from Lori in San Diego. She says, excellent. Thanks for standing up with her on this. Now, regarding my debate that I did a few weeks ago with Justin Lee, a Christian who believes it is okay to be in a same-sex relationship. This is from Michaeline. She says, great job, really thought-provoking stuff. This is from Patty. Bob, you did a great job yesterday. Well, when she wrote it to me, it was yesterday. It's a few weeks ago now. From Valia, she said, great interview, not enough time. I heard that from a lot of people. They said they would have liked to have heard more time. They would have liked to heard Justin develop his argument from scripture. But I got to tell you something, to prepare for that debate, I listened to a 2.5 hour debate with Justin Lee, and you don't really get a whole lot more. There are a few games he could have played with some Greek. I was prepared for that. We didn't get to it. But more or less, ladies and gentlemen, you heard his argument. He says that the passages which say homosexuality is wrong are talking about homosexuality outside of a monogamous relationship. And he believes that if it is a monogamous relationship, it's okay. And he did make that point very clearly on our program. If it sounded like he didn't get a chance to develop his position, maybe it's because the position really doesn't have a whole lot of legs on it. Now, this is from Fran regarding that. She says, okay, I just listened to the program. Two things. Kudos to Justin for being brave to answer questions and give his feedback on such a sensitive yet vital conversation. Secondly, to you, Bob, on being such a gracious host. You were not there to attack anyone. I saw you as a bridge between two volatile sets of people, the religious Puritans and the aggressive gay community. My take on the program is that it was very successful. You both were sincere, gracious, and respectful. Thank you for kindly approaching to bridge the gap and teach us to create an atmosphere of Christ-like love. After all, like you said, who among us is not dealing with issues of a sinful nature? I understood what Justin was saying about longing for someone to grow old with. It can be painful to be alone, I know fully. But we are all to remain celibate before marriage and faithful during marriage. My thought was to the married person who's in a loveless marriage. Does that give them a license to seek out someone else? Not if they trust God. He is still in the miracle business. Anyway, I really enjoyed the program. Well, thank you. That was very encouraging, Fran. And let me use that as an example. Fran's talking about how loving I was being. And yet, at other times, I've done political satire about militant Muslims. So you see, it's not one size fits all. There are different ways to make points. Looking for a church that will not only challenge you, but help you to feel like a part of a family? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego near 94 in Hamasha? I can testify firsthand to Skyline because I myself am a member. When you visit, tell them Bob Siegel sent you and ask about that free week-long trip to Bermuda for first-time visitors. They'll look at you like they don't know what you're talking about, and you will not, in fact, get any free trip to Bermuda. But you'll still be glad for a chance to experience Skyline Church. You don't want to go to Bermuda anyway. Too hot. And people who approach that area have been known to disappear. But they don't disappear at Skyline. Those who visit usually can't wait to come back. Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. Reading some comments regarding the debate I did with Justin Lee a couple of weeks ago regarding the issue of whether it's okay to be Christian and live a gay lifestyle at the same time. This one is from Mike. He says, Bob, really good job. Definitely came across as compassionate, yet not backing down on correctly interpreting scripture. From Teddy, she says, good job, Bob. I just pray he'd stop twisting the word of God to suit himself and his friends. He needs to understand that truth does not care about your opinion. And then from Larry, he says, great summary, especially your wrap-up that there are no verses condoning homosexuality, so the Bible is not conflicted thereon. Okay, now, I think it was a couple of months ago now, I did a series for a couple of weeks about the testimony of Jesus outside of the New Testament. What I'm going to do today, and depending on how much we get through, we might continue some of this next week, going to do kind of a companion piece to that. And I'm going to talk about other people that we read about in the New Testament. And there are some histories that verify that. I've talked a lot about the Jewish historian Josephus. Josephus was not a Christian. And yet John the Baptist, who was the forerunner of Jesus, is talked about with quite a bit of detail from Josephus. And I'm reading from his Antiquities. He said, now, by the way, he's talking here about Herod and Herod's armies. And I should tell you, there are about as many Herods in the Bible as there are stars in the sky and sand on the seashore. So So the Herod he's talking about, this is not Herod the Great who tried to have baby Jesus killed. That Herod has passed away, and then he split up the territory amongst his sons. This is Herod Antipas. And he's talking about the fact that Herod Antipas had gotten into a war with an Arabian king and had lost the battle, and then the Romans had to bail him out. And the people interpreted the victory of that war going to the Arabians because they felt God was punishing him for the way he treated John the Baptist. So actually, Josephus isn't taking that much interest as John the Baptist. As Christians, of course, the passage just jumps off the page at us. But he's taking kind of a casual interest in John the Baptist. He's mostly talking about Herod, but he is putting this footnote in here. So he says, now some of the Jews thought that Herod's army had been destroyed by God and that it was a very just penalty to avenge John, surnamed the Baptist. For Herod had killed him, though he was a good man who bade the Jews practice virtue, be just one to another, and pious toward God, and come together in baptism. He taught that baptism was acceptable to God, provided that they underwent it not to procure remission of certain sins, but for the purification of the body, if the soul had already been purified by righteousness. Now, this is a very important statement because, as you know, there are all kinds of different denominations with different views of baptism. Some say baptism is just a ritual. It has nothing to do with our salvation. Others claim that we're not saved until we actually get baptized. One of the reasons for the confusion is that when we get to the New Testament, we just see that this is a practice that the Jews had. Now, that practice did not exist under the Old Testament law. Oh, there were some purification washings that priests went through, and perhaps this is related to that. But by the time we get to Jesus' day, and there was a 400-year period of silence between the Old and the New Testament because God didn't send them a prophet at that time. John the Baptist was the first prophet that had come to Israel in 400 years, and that's why he was the biggest thing in town, and people were just rushing out to see him. And not only that, but the last prophet who had written, Malachi, said that before the Messiah came, God would send Elijah the prophet. It's funny, Jews today don't believe in the second coming of Christ, but they do believe in the second coming of Elijah. Elijah the prophet had not experienced death. He had been raptured into heaven, and so all kinds of folklore and legendary sayings from the rabbis developed. And a lot of that centered around the fact that the last time they had heard from a prophet 400 years ago, they said before the Messiah comes, Elijah will come first. So there's two reasons people are flocking out to John the Baptist. One is that God hasn't spoken to them for 400 years and now he's sending a prophet again. But the other reason is maybe he's Elijah, because the last time we did hear from a prophet, he said that Elijah would come. So they came out. So what we notice here is that John the Baptist is baptizing people, baptizing meaning he held them under the water and then pulled them out again. This is obviously a practice that the Jews are very familiar with, but nowhere in the Bible do we have an explanation of exactly what it meant. Well, Josephus is providing that explanation. Now, some people say, well, if it's not in the Bible, then it means nothing. Well, it should mean something to you, my friend, because you can't isolate the Bible from the culture it came out of. The Bible is corroborated by other historical documents. And Josephus is making it very clear here that in John's baptism, you weren't purifying the soul. The soul had already been purified. So evidently the salvation, the repentance, which you needed to do, you had already done before baptism. The relationship between baptism and salvation can be likened to the relationship between a marriage ceremony and a commitment, or a marriage ceremony and a wedding ring. If a husband decides to be unfaithful to his wife, the fact that he's wearing a ring means nothing. On the other hand, if somebody says, well, I'm going to be faithful to you, but I still don't want to wear my wedding ring when I go into singles bars, well, then all of a sudden, you see, the wedding ring is important or not important depending on the context. If you're wearing it but you're not faithful, it doesn't mean anything. On the other hand, if you're claiming you're faithful but you're not willing to wear it, well, that tells you something too. So baptism is kind of a test. And this is explained pretty clearly by Josephus anyway, from a historical point of view, even though I'm getting into a little theology here. From a historical point of view, this is a verification that there was a John the Baptist. He wasn't some made-up character in the Gospels. So let me read this part again. He taught that baptism was acceptable to God, provided that they underwent it, not to procure remission of certain sins, but for the purification of the body if the soul had already been purified by righteousness. And when the others gathered around him, for they were greatly moved when they heard his words, Herod feared that his persuasive power over men being so great might lead to a rising, as they seemed ready to follow his counsel in everything. So he thought it much better to seize and kill him before he caused any tumult and after repent of falling into such trouble later on after a revolt had taken place. Because of this suspicion of Herod, John was sent in chains to Machaerus, the fortress which we mentioned above, and there put to death. The Jews believed that it was to avenge him that disaster fell upon the army, God wishing to bring evil upon Herod. So again, this is Herod the son. But of course, there's all kinds of history about his father, Herod the Great. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Herod the Great. Under the Romans, he had managed to obtain the title King of the Jews. He was the son of a guy named Antipater II. He came from the area that was Edom, which would today be Jordan. And he managed to secure for himself a place of power under the Romans. As procurator of Judea, he appointed his own son Herod as kind of a governor. They called him a tetrarch. A tetrarch meant the governor of a fourth of a province. So there'd be three other governors. And we'll talk more about this when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. Bobsiegel.net.
Talking about people that are listed in the New Testament that are corroborated by other history. And right now we're talking about Herod the Great, infamous for being the person who wanted to kill baby Jesus. And he failed in that attempt, but he slaughtered many other children while he was trying. So he was the son of a man named Antipater II, who appointed his son Herod as the Tetrarch of Galilee. Now, after the murder of Julius Caesar, Antipater and his son showed loyalty to a new regime by Cassius, by zealously correcting tribute for him. But then Mark Antony, you might recall, with your basic Roman history, defeated Brutus and Cassius at Philippi. Asia fell into the hands of a new Roman regime. Herod, an opportunist, quickly changed his loyalties and bribed his way to favor with Antony. Antony bestowed upon him the title King of the Jews. Herod ruled for 33 years. Now, here's the thing. Nobody's denying that Herod existed, but sometimes when people can't deny that these people existed, then what they'll say is, oh, well, Herod, as he's portrayed in the New Testament, was inaccurate. And as you're going to see in a couple of minutes, they do the same thing with Pontius Pilate. They say the Pontius Pilate in the Bible is nothing like the real Pontius Pilate in history. So here's what they're trying to say about King Herod. They're saying, well, we don't have any record that Herod went and slaughtered children. First of all, folks, there could have been all kinds of records. There was one record, the record that we read in the Gospel of Matthew. There probably were other records, but a lot of the things from that age have not survived. That doesn't mean we ignore what has survived. But here's the thing. In some little village, some little town of Bethlehem, that might not have been significant to the major historians of his day. What we need to look at to evaluate this is whether there was precedent. And one of the things is they say, well, this doesn't even make any sense. Here's a guy in his 70s, and he's told that the Messiah could be 2 years old or younger. Why would he be worried that somebody 2 years old is going to take his kingdom away? By the time the two-year-old grows up, he's going to be dead. Well, that makes sense if Herod was a person who made sense. But let's look at some things we do know about Herod from other history. Herod, in the last part of his rule, became extremely bitter and cruel. He was infamous for his jealousy and suspicion. He married a woman named Marimani, who was, she was related to the Hasmoneans. That was the last dynasty that had ruled in Israel before the Romans came and took it away from them. And he did that to make his reign more legitimate. So he wasn't really Jewish, so he married a Jewish woman. Herod, because of his suspicions, had his 17-year-old brother killed. He had his uncle Joseph killed. He had his wife's grandfather killed. He murdered the guard of the queen. Heck, he killed the queen. He killed two of his sons. Then he killed his oldest son, but he loved his pets. There's a quote from those days that said, "I would rather be one of Herod's pigs than a member of his family." Folks, does this sound like somebody who might have gone off on a crusade to kill baby Jesus? Absolutely, it does. So when people say that the Herod of history doesn't match the character of the Herod of the Bible, they simply don't know what they're talking about. Now, this is our third Herod that we're going to look at. We looked at Herod Antipas, Herod the Great. This one is Herod Agrippa, the grandson of Herod the Great. And in the book of Josephus, we have an account about how he died. What's interesting is this agrees with the Gospel of Luke. Luke, by the way, was also a historian. I know we read about Luke in a book that we call the Bible, but that doesn't mean it wasn't accurate history. Luke was writing for a man named Theophilus, who was evidently a Roman dignitary. It was very common in those days for patrons to sponsor investigations. Somebody had sponsored and paid the passage for Luke to visit Judea and interview the people who had known Jesus. But anyway, was Luke's account something that agreed with Josephus's account? Well, let's start with Josephus's account. I'm reading from his book called The Antiquity of the Jews. When Agrippa, meaning Herod Agrippa, when Agrippa had reigned 3 full years over all Judea, he came to the city of Caesarea, which was formerly called Strato's Tower, the original name of Caesarea. There he exhibited shows in honor of Caesar, inaugurating this as a festival for the emperor's welfare. And there came together to it a multitude of the provincial officials and of those who had been promoted to a distinguished position. On the second day of the shows, he put on robe all made of silver of altogether wonderful weaving and arrived in the theater at break of day. Then the silver shone as the sun's first rays fell upon it and glittered wonderfully, its resplendence inspiring a sort of fear and trembling in those who gazed upon it. Immediately his flatterers called out from various quarters in words which in truth were not for his good, addressing him as a god and invoking him with a cry, "Be propitious. If hitherto we have revered thee as a human being, yet henceforth we confess thee to be superior to mortal nature." The king did not rebuke them, nor did he repudiate their impious flattery, but looking up soon afterwards, he saw the owl sitting on a rope above his head and immediately recognized it as a messenger of evil, as it had formerly been a messenger of good, and a pang of grief pierced his heart. There came also a severe pain in his belly, beginning with a violent attack. So he was carried quickly into the palace, and the news sped abroad among all that he would certainly die before long. And when he had suffered continuously for 5 days from the pain in his belly, he departed this life in the 54th year of his age and the 7th of his reign. Okay, very interesting. So he's basically saying that the guy gave a speech. People started calling him God. He loved being deified, and he dropped dead. Now, that's the kind of thing we'd normally expect to read in the Bible, somebody dropping dead because someone else is calling them God, God judging them for it. But we didn't read that in the Bible. We read that in the works of the historian Josephus. Well, now let's look at the passage in the Bible. Now, the information's different. It's not contradictory. It's different, which is good. If it was word for word, what would the skeptics say? Oh, Luke just got a copy of Josephus and copied it. It's good that they're worded differently because it proves that we have two different yet corroborating historical sources. So now I'm reading from Acts chapter 12, verses 19 through 22. Then Herod went from Judea to Caesarea and stayed there. He had been quarreling with the people of Tyre and Sidon. They now joined together and sought an audience with him. After securing the support of Blastus, a trusted personal servant of the king, they asked for peace because they depended on the king's country for their food supply. On the appointed day, Herod, wearing his royal robes, sat on his throne and delivered a public address to the people. They shouted, "This is the voice of a god, not of a man." Immediately, because Herod did not give the praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down, and he was eaten by worms, and he died. Okay, Pontius Pilate. Well, we know he existed. In the year 1961, they actually found an inscription on limestone with Pilate's name in the dedication of a temple worship at Caesarea, a dedication to the emperor. Pilate's name is the one. And then the Roman historian Tacitus talks about Pilate when he was investigating Christianity. Tacitus lived between the years 56 to 117 AD, approximately, when the great fire of Rome was blamed on Christians. Tacitus went and investigated Christianity. He didn't seem to like Christians. He called them superstitious, but that's okay, because historically, this is really good news. Look at what he says. Their originator, Christ, had been executed in Tiberius's reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. But in spite of this, so not only is he verifying that Pontius Pilate existed, he's verifying that Christ existed. But in spite of this temporary setback, the deadly superstition had broken out afresh, not only in Judea, where the mischief had started, but even in Rome. All degraded and shameful practices collect and flourish in the capital. He doesn't like Christians. He's calling them degraded, shameful. But isn't it interesting what he's saying about Jesus here? He's calling the belief in Jesus a deadly superstition. And he's saying the death of Christ stopped the superstition, but the superstition broke out afresh. Well, if the death of Christ stopped the superstition, what is it he's talking about that made it break out afresh? My friends, he's referring to the resurrection. At least the claims of the resurrection, even though they were things he didn't personally believe. But I'll talk more about Pontius Pilate next week.
Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.